Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 100.
Tang Monk and the three disciples have just been whisked away from Shen Family Village. It's the eight great Jin Gang, these powerful guardians, lifting them up on a gust of wind. Up they go.
Right. And what happens right after the village is fascinating.
Yeah.
The villagers wake up, Tang Monk's gone. And yeah, there's panic at first, you know, where did the living Buddha go? But almost immediately, that flips.
That's how.
Into worship.
Yeah.
Pure veneration. The monastery there, the Saving Life Monastery, it instantly becomes this holy site. The text is really specific. Four big sacrifices, 24 small sacrifices every single year. Constant incense, lamps always burning. It shows how his miraculous departure cemented his legacy right there instantly.
Wow. So his absence became as powerful as his presence almost. Okay, so they're flying back with the Jin Gang on this second gust of fragrant wind, heading straight for Chang. Super fast return journey.
Super fast, yeah. But then there's this curious little detail. The Jin Gang decide not to fly right down into the city itself.
Why not?
Well, their reasoning, according to the text, is pretty down to earth, actually. They say the city people are clever and might leak their appearance, you know, spread stories about seeing celestial beings. Plus, there was this background pressure, a kind of time crunch.
A time crunch.
From who? From Guanyin, apparently. Yeah. She'd told the Buddha the whole scripture mission needed wrapping up in 8 days, and they'd already used up more than 4 days. And they were specifically worried about Baji.
Zhu Baji, let me guess. Worried he'd get distracted.
Exactly. That he might covet wealth and riches if they landed right in the capital and, you know, hold things up.
Yeah.
Delay getting back to the Buddha. It's funny, right? Even divine missions have these very human, practical worries. Deadlines and problematic colleagues.
Huh. Yeah, that sounds about right for Baji. But Sun Wukong, he pushes back, doesn't he? He's the practical one.
He is. He basically says, hang on, how's our master supposed to carry all these scriptures and lead the horse by himself? He argues they have to go down with Tang Monk to actually deliver the goods.
Makes sense.
And Baji's response is just classic Baji. He laughs it off, basically says, me, greedy. My master is becoming a Buddha. I want to become a Buddha too. I wouldn't dare. And he promises he'll head right back up with them afterwards. It just adds that touch of personality, you know. These are just symbols. They're characters right to the end.
Okay, so they do descend. And the arrival, it's pretty dramatic, right? Near this special tower outside Chang'an.
That's right, the Looking for Scriptures Tower.
Hmm.
The text mentions Yan Gate, but contextually it's Chang'an. And Emperor Taizong, he's been waiting. Apparently he had this tower built 3 years after Tang Monk left and came back every year hoping.
Wow, dedication.
Totally. And the arrival itself has these auspicious signs, the kind-filled propitious clouds, this fragrant wind. But my favorite detail, it involves pine trees.
Pine trees.
Yeah, back at Hongfu Temple, which was Tang Monk's old monastery in Chang'an. The monks there suddenly notice all the pine tree branches are pointing eastward, mysteriously.
Mm-hmm.
No wind, nothing. They're just all turned east.
Okay, that's weirdly specific. What's that about?
Well, it turns out one of Tang Monk's old disciples remembers something their master said years before he left. A prophecy.
A prophecy? What did it say?
He recalled Tang Monk saying, after I leave, maybe in 3 years, maybe five, maybe six or seven, if you see the pine branches turn east, that means I'm coming back.
Whoa. So it's like nature itself announcing his return based on his own words from years ago. That's quite a connection.
Exactly. It ties the departure and return together in this really beautiful, almost magical way.
So the signs are there. The prophecy's fulfilled. Emperor Taizong sees them from the tower.
And he comes right down. Greets Tang Monk personally. He's curious about the three new companions, obviously. And word just spreads like wildfire through Chang'an. He's back. The scripture seeker is back.
Okay, so into the palace they go, the imperial court.
Yep. Tang Monk presents the horse, the original imperial horse, and of course the main event, the Mountain of Scriptures. Kaizong gives Tang Monk a seat, which is a huge honor, and then gets right down to business. He asks the key questions. So how many scriptures did you get? And tell me how you actually obtained them.
Right, the big reveal. And Tang Monk starts explaining they got to Vulture Peak. They met the Buddha himself.
They had a meal first, apparently. Then Buddha's disciples, Ananda and Kasyapa, took them to the treasure pavilion to get the scriptures.
Standard procedure, sounds like.
You'd think.
Yeah.
But this is where it gets really interesting. Tang Monk explains that Ananda and Kasyapa flat out demanded personal gifts. A bribe, essentially.
Wait, Buddha's own chief disciples demanding gifts for sacred scriptures.
That's what the text says. And because Tang Monk hadn't brought anything extra, hadn't prepared any gifts, they gave him blank scrolls, empty scriptures.
No words, just blank pages.
completely blank. They didn't even realize it at first. It was only later, when some demon wind blew the scrolls around and they checked them, they saw there was nothing written on them at all. Imagine the shock.
I can't even. So what did Tang Monk do? He must have been furious.
He went straight back to the Buddha, complained, you know, what's this all about? They gave us empty books.
And what was Buddha's response to that? I mean, his own disciples pulling this stunt.
Okay, get ready for this. Buddha's justification is kind of mind-bending. He basically says, yeah, that happens. He even tells a story about it.
He tells a story about blank scriptures.
Sort of. He recounts this time when another monk, ages ago, took the scriptures down the mountain to recite them for some wealthy guy. And that monk only asked for, the text says, three sheng of rice grain gold, which was like a decent amount, but maybe not huge.
Okay. So what's the point?
Buddha says that monk still felt he'd sold them too cheaply. And because of that, his descendants ended up poor.
Wait, so Buddha is saying scriptures shouldn't be given away for free or cheaply, that there's a price.
That seems to be the implication. Like, there's this cosmic rule that true, valuable things, even sacred knowledge, can't just be handed over without some kind of exchange. Tang Monk heard this story and, well, he got the message.
So to get the real scriptures, the ones with words.
He had to pay up. He had to give Ananda and Kasyapa his most valuable personal possession from the journey's start. That imperial purple gold begging bowl the emperor had given him.
The emperor's gift. Wow. That was the price.
That was the price for the true written scriptures. It's a really complex point, isn't it?
Yeah.
About value, exchange, even in the holiest of places.
It really is. Okay, so he pays the price. He gets the real scriptures. How many were there in the end? What was the final count?
The final tally was impressive. It came out to 35 sections total. And within those sections, there were several scrolls from each, adding up to exactly 5,048 scrolls. Enough to fill, as the text says, one Tripitaka, the entire canon of Buddhist teachings.
5,048 scrolls, that's monumental. A library of wisdom earned through incredible hardship. And Emperor Taizong, he's just overjoyed, completely ecstatic.
And the first thing he does is throw a party, basically.
Pretty much. A magnificent banquet right away at the East Pavilion of the Guanglu Temple. A huge imperial gesture. Shows relief, power, everything.
So it's a grand stage. But then, amidst all the pomp, the emperor asks a really direct question, doesn't he?
He does. He looks at Senzang's companions, Sun Wukong, Zhu Baji, Shabujing, and he sees their abnormal appearance.
The abnormal appearance, right.
And he just asks Senzang point blank, are these guys foreigners?
Is he just genuinely confused by, you know, a monkey, a pig spirit, and a river ogre showing up? Or is it something deeper, like an imperial way of asking, what are these beings you brought back?
That's a great way to put it. I think it's probably both. Genuine surprise, for sure. I mean, they don't look like your average traveler.
Definitely not.
But yeah, maybe also that subtle probe you mentioned, trying to understand the scale of the journey, how Senzang managed these powerful, wild figures.
And Senzang's response is pretty humble, right? He just introduces them.
Very humble. He goes through each one, gives their full name, their Dharma name, that's their spiritual name after converting, and even a little, sometimes slightly mischievous backstory.
It's like presenting his redeemed monster squad to the court.
Yeah. Yeah, sort of. Mm. So first up, Sun Wukong. Can you imagine the emperor's reaction when Senzang says, oh yeah, this is Sun Wukong. You might remember him as the great sage equaling heaven.
The guy who wrecked heaven 500 years ago. That guy.
The very same. Senzang mentions his birth on Flower Fruit Mountain, the chaos in heaven, being trapped under Two Boundary Mountain by Buddha himself.
Wow, quite the CV.
And then rescued by Guanyin Bodhisattva to protect Senzang. Senzang makes it clear this former troublemaker was essential for their protection. He needed him.
Okay, so that's Wukong. Then who's next? Zhu Baji.
Yep, Zhu Baji. Surname Zhu, Dharma name Vuning. Senzang explains he was a troublemaker too, originally from Cloud Pathway Cave, causing issues down in Gao Village.
Always causing trouble, these guys.
Seems to be a theme. Again, Guanyin encouraged his conversion, and Wukong actually had to subdue him initially.
Ah, so Wukong put him in his place.
Right. But despite his, let's say, earthy appetites and past, Senzang highlights his vital role. Carrying the luggage, navigating rivers and water obstacles. Super important practical stuff.
Okay, makes sense. And the third one, Sha Wujing.
Sha Wujing, surname Sha, Dharma name Wujing. Also known as Sha Hesheng, or Friar Sand. Another former troublemaker, this time from the Flowing Sand River.
Spotting a pattern here. Guanyin involved again.
You guessed it. Converted by Guanyin. Sanzang presents him as more understated, maybe quieter, but just as crucial. The steady one, perhaps.
So, three redeemed demons, essentially. But what about the horse? The Emperor noticed something about the horse, too, right?
He did. He points out that the horse looks exactly like the one he originally gave Sanzang 14 years ago.
Which is unlikely after that kind of journey.
Extremely unlikely. And Sanzang gives this incredible explanation. He says the original horse, it was swallowed.
Swallowed by what?
By this horse. Or rather, the creature this horse used to be. Back at Snake Coil Mountain, Eagle Grief Stream.
Okay, wait. So this horse ate the original horse?
Sort of. This steed is actually the son of the West Sea Dragon King. He'd also committed sins, was facing punishment, but Guanyin rescued him too.
Guanyin's been busy.
Very busy. And she had him transform into the exact likeness of the original horse to serve Sanzang. So its role wasn't just carrying Sanzang across mountains.
It's also carrying the scriptures themselves back.
Precisely. Another redeemed being crucial to the mission's success. It's a fantastic detail.
It really is. So the Emperor hears all this. He must be pretty impressed.
Utterly. He praises them all endlessly. And then he asks the big practical question. Just how far was this journey?
And Sanzang has an answer.
He does. He confirms Guanyin's original estimate. 108,000 miles.
Which is a lot.
It's huge. Roughly 33,000 miles, or about 54,000 kilometers, on foot, mostly. Just think about that.
Wow. And the time. He confirmed the 14 years.
Yep. He says he didn't count every single day, naturally, but he states it clearly. 14 cold and hot seasons, so 14 years.
14 years, that's just staggering, the sheer endurance.
And he emphasizes how tough it was. Constant mountains, ridges, thick forests, wide rivers, day in, day out. Grueling.
But then he provides something really concrete, doesn't he? Something almost bureaucratic.
He does. This is maybe my favorite part. He pulls out the Tongguan Wendy, the customs clearance document.
Their passport. Like, literally a travel document.
Essentially, yes. A record of every kingdom they pass through, stamped with official seals, proof of travel. He hands it straight to the emperor.
That is amazing. What does the emperor make of it?
Taizong looks at it, notes the date it was issued. Back in the 13th year of his reign, Zenguan.
Okay.
Then he points out, well, it's now the 27th year of Zenguan.
Ah, simple maths. 27 minus 13.
It's 14 years. Right there. Documented proof. It's like Tang Dynasty trip verification.
Unbelievable. And it wasn't just one stamp, was it?
Oh, no. It lists the seals from all the major places. You know, Boxiang country, Wuji country, Chechi country, even the famous Women's Kingdom of Jiliang.
The Women's Kingdom.
Right. Yeah. Pisa country, Zuzi country, Lion Camel country, remember that one? Bikshu country, Annihilation of Dharma country, plus several big prefectures like Fengxian, Yuhua, and Jingping.
So it's a whole itinerary officially validated.
Exactly. A comprehensive travelogue proving they went through all these diverse lands. It's incredibly precise for such a mythical journey.
It really grounds it, doesn't it? Even on a divine mission, you need your papers stamped. What does that say about the Tang worldview? Order, maybe? Accountability?
I think so. It grounds the epic in something relatable, something regulated. It subtly reinforces the idea of the Tang administration's reach and importance, and maybe suggests that the effort, the documented journey itself, contributed to earning their enlightenment, their Tao fruit. It's not just divine magic, it's legwork, too.
That makes a lot of sense. So they presented the proof, told the stories, now comes the feast, right?
Right. But first, Taizong asks Sun Zhang if the disciples, you know how to behave at court.
Huh. A valid question, given their origins.
Sanzang is very honest. He basically says, look, they're mountain village, wild field demon bodies. They don't really know the etiquette of your sacred dynasty.
Refreshingly direct.
And the emperor seems amused by it. He just waves it off and invites everyone to the East Pavilion for the banquet.
And the description of the place is pretty lavish.
Oh, completely. The text goes all out. Gates hung with colorful embroidery, floors covered in red felt, exotic aromas, fresh delicacies everywhere.
Sounds fancy.
And the tableware. Get this. Amber cups, glass goblets inlaid with gold and kingfisher feathers, golden plates, white jade bowls with floral patterns, just dripping with luxury.
Wow. So a feast fit for an emperor welcoming back heroes.
But
then comes the surprise.
The big surprise. It's entirely vegetarian.
For an imperial banquet. That seems unusual.
Very unusual, especially for the time, perhaps.
Right.
But it's a huge testament to Sanzang's Buddhist vows, which clearly influenced the whole event. And this wasn't just, you know, boiled vegetables.
No. What was on the menu?
It sounds incredible. The text lists things like boiled turnips, sugar glazed taro, Okay, maybe start simple, but then sweet mushrooms, clear sea vegetables, ginger-spiced bamboo shoots, honey-glazed sunflower seeds.
Getting more interesting.
Oh, yeah. Gluten with Chinese toon tree leaves, wood ear fungus, and tofu skin. Exotic stuff like stone flower immortal vegetable. That's a type of seaweed fern root powder, Osmond.
Okay, now you're losing me, but it sounds diverse.
It is. Peppercorn boiled radish, mustard mixed cucumber strips, and the fruits.
Oh, the fruits must have been something else.
Unbelievable list. Walnuts, persimmon cakes, long and lychee, special chestnuts from Xuanzu, dates from Shandong, ginkgo from Jiangyin, pears shaped like rabbit heads.
Rabbit head pears. Okay.
Hazelnuts, pine nuts, lotus seeds, huge grapes, torreya nuts, melon seeds, water chestnut rice, olives, crab apples, sugar apples, sand pears, water chestnuts, tender lotus roots, crisp plums, bayberries. It just goes on and on.
That is an astonishing spread.
Yeah.
Especially for a vegetarian feast.
Right. Plus all sorts of steamed pastries, honey treats, fine wines, presumably vegetarian wines or grain alcohols, fragrant teas, other exotic things. It's a culinary tour de force.
And the text itself makes a point about this.
It does. It concludes the description by saying the feast truly shows the Central Kingdom is different from the Western barbarians, which, you know, in context, is a big statement of cultural pride and abundance, China showcasing its best.
A very Tang Dynasty way to celebrate.
Yeah.
So after this incredible meal, they head back to the temple.
Yeah. Evening falls, the court disperses, and the pilgrims return to Hongfu Temple, and there's another sign waiting for them.
Oh. What's this one?
The monks at the temple report something amazing, the trees right outside the temple. That very morning, they'd suddenly leaned eastward.
Eastward. Eesh. Towards the direction they were coming from.
Exactly. Just as Sun Zhang had apparently predicted they would upon their return. A little miracle. A sign from the natural world acknowledging their arrival.
Wow, that's a lovely touch. A subtle, natural confirmation.
But the biggest sign of change is in the disciples themselves.
How so? They're not causing trouble.
Not at all. It's striking. Even Zubaji, you know, the one always complaining about being hungry or causing a fuss.
Yeah.
He's quiet. Composed, not making demands for food, not being loud, just calm.
And Wukong and Xiao Wujing.
Same thing. Steady, dignified, serene. A world away from the rambunctious figures they were.
That's a huge shift, especially for Baji. What happened? Is it just exhaustion?
No, it's more profound than that. The text implies their spiritual quest is truly complete. They've achieved their Dao fruit.
Their Dao fruit, meaning enlightenment.
Essentially, yes. The culmination of their journey, their spiritual development, this newfound tranquility, this composure, it's the outward sign of that inner transformation. They've finally arrived, body and spirit. And the very next morning, the text says, Emperor Taizong, who was apparently so moved, so impressed, he stayed up all night thinking about it.
Yeah, couldn't sleep.
He's addressing his officials, and he didn't just, you know, throw a welcome home parade or something. No, he actually wrote this deeply personal, really philosophical tribute.
It's amazing, isn't it? This text, the preface to the Holy Teachings, yeah. The Sheng Jiao Shu, it's so much more than just a well done.
Right.
It's this really profound philosophical statement. And, you know, it gives us incredible insight into how the Dharma, the Buddhist teachings were understood right then at that level. It was blending things too, but a Taoist thought woven in.
Mm-hmm.
Very clever politically.
Wow. Okay. So he's not just a ruler saying, good job. He's properly engaging with the ideas. And it starts off, well, pretty philosophical, doesn't it? Talking about two forms, four seasons, the visible and invisible. Like some truths are obvious, even to the common fool, as he puts it.
Mm-hmm.
But the deeper stuff, the formless wisdom,
yeah,
that's harder to get. It really sets up this difference between everyday reality and this profound Buddhist wisdom. Right?
Precisely. And that philosophical opening, it's not just fancy words. It works to elevate the Buddhist teachings.
Mm-hmm.
It's saying, look, basic stuff is easy, but this wisdom, this needs real understanding.
Ah.
So it legitimizes Buddhism's unique value, and it underlines why they needed these specific texts that Sun Zhang risked everything for.
Right.
It frames the Dharma as, well, essential. Absolutely vital for real insight.
And then he describes the Dharma itself, and the language is just huge. He says it fills the universe, but at the same time, it gathers in a hair's breadth.
That contrast, yeah.
It has no extinction or birth. It lasts forever through 1,000 kalpas. He paints it as this immense, subtle, eternal force. It sounds like more than just an endorsement. It's like he's declaring it a universal truth.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
The emperor, the highest authority, is giving Buddhism this supreme official stamp of approval.
Mm-hmm.
He's framing it as the ultimate truth for everyone. And this wasn't just, you know, a political nod. Taizong's intellectual engagement in the preface basically wove Buddhism into the fabric of imperial rule.
Mm-hmm.
It became more than just religion. It became sort of a tool for good governance.
Yeah.
A massive shift.
Okay, so that sets the stage. Then the emperor's preface turns specifically to Xuanzang himself. And the praise is really something. He calls him the leader of the Buddhist Dharma.
Yes.
Praises his early wisdom, describes his purity like pine wind and water moon. It's very poetic, very striking language.
And it's not just empty flattery, you know. These descriptions paint Huizong as uniquely qualified, but also driven by this genuine spiritual need. The emperor points out his motivation was to fix the decline of the true Dharma, correct the errors in profound texts that had shown up in China.
Ah, so there was a perceived problem he was solving.
Exactly. It emphasizes why the quest was so necessary, and it authenticates the teachings Huizong brought back.
Yeah.
He wasn't just collecting books, he was restoring something vital.
And the preface really hammers home how tough the journey was. It mentions him facing dangers, dealing with snow in the morning, sandstorms at night.
Yeah, the descriptions are vivid.
And it repeats traveling for 14 years, visiting countless countries. It really drives home the sheer effort involved.
It does. And what's fascinating is how the text stresses the personal sacrifice.
Mm.
It even says heavy sincerity, light labor, meaning his incredible devotion made the impossible seem, well, achievable. That detail really underscores the value of the teachings. It's not just the knowledge, but the immense commitment behind getting it, which makes the Dharma he brought back feel even more potent, more precious.
So what did all that effort actually bring back? The tangible results, the emperor lists them. 35 major Mahayana texts, totaling 50 over 48 scrolls. That's specific.
Very specific. A huge amount of material.
And he uses that wonderful imagery. Xuanzang brought a cloud of mercy from the West, causing the rain of Dharma to fall on the East, leading people out of suffering. It's beautiful, really.
It is. And the preface ends with this really insightful analogy about cassia trees on high mountains, lotuses in pure water.
Right. I remember that part.
Suggesting that good and evil are kind of self-made, but
yeah.
Being near purity like the Dharma, it elevates everything, even plants, let alone people. It really makes you think, doesn't it? What does this analogy tell you about how the emperor saw the Dharma actually changing people?
Yeah, like it's transformative just by being near it.
Exactly. Not just intellectual understanding, but a real shift in being.
So after this incredible preface gets read out loud, Xuanzang responds very humbly, you know, gives thanks. And Taizong is almost modest about his own writing skills, which is interesting.
A bit of imperial modesty, perhaps.
But then, boom, they immediately switch to practicalities. How do we actually get these scriptures out there?
And what's really interesting here, I think, is Xuanzang's insistence. He doesn't want to just start reading them in the palace.
No.
He says they need a proper Buddha land for recitation.
Ah, okay. So a sacred space.
Yes. It really highlights the sanctity of the texts. They're not just documents for the court. They require a spiritual setting. It's a subtle but important distinction.
So they decide on the Wild Goose Pagoda Temple. Makes sense. But then Xuanzang gives this really key instruction. Copies have to be made for distribution, sure, but the originals, they have to be carefully preserved, not damaged, not desecrated.
Super important.
And they actually built a whole new place just for this, the copying yellow temple, the Tenkuangsi. Imagine building a dedicated facility just for copying.
It's incredible, isn't it? If you step back and think about it, that's remarkable knowledge management for the 7th century.
Yeah, really.
It's not just about getting the word out. It's about ensuring authenticity, making sure these texts last for future generations.
Yeah.
That careful preservation, it's just as crucial as spreading the teachings. It's about protecting the integrity of this precious heritage.
Okay, so they're all set up at the Wild Goose Pagoda, platform built. Xuanzang is presumably just about to start reciting. And then something completely unexpected happens, just out of nowhere.
This is the really dramatic part.
Yeah. The text says, 8 great Vajras, these powerful Buddhist guardian figures, they just appear from thin air.
Wow.
And they basically deliver a command. Your work here is done. Time to come back to the West. And instantly, Xuanzang, his disciples, even the white horse that carried the scriptures,
the whole crew,
they just ascend straight up to the 9th heaven, leaving Emperor Taizong and all the officials just standing there, bowing, completely stunned.
It's such a powerful image. And it's not just you know, a convenient way to end the story. This divine ascension is the ultimate stamp of approval.
Right, the ultimate validation.
Exactly. It tells everyone, the emperor, the court, the whole empire, really, that this mission wasn't just a human success. It was divinely ordained and completed. It's like the cosmos itself saying mission accomplished. It seals the sacred nature of everything they did and brought back.
And the story wraps up with this poem, kind of summarizing everything. It talks about the 14 years of hardship, the mission being completed.
Yeah, bringing it all together.
And crucially, how the Great Enlightenment's wondrous text now remains in the East, where it will be forever propagated.
And that final act on the ground is Taizong establishing the Waterland Assembly, a major Buddhist ritual, and making sure those copies they made, they get distributed all across the land.
Tang Monk and his disciples, they arrive back at Ling Mountain. The text mentions the 8 Vajra get them there from Chang'an, right within that 8-day limit Guanyin set, which is, frankly, pretty incredible timing.
It really is. 8 days.
And when they get there, all the gods, the deities, they're already assembled. Before Rulai, the Buddha, talk about pressure.
Oh, definitely. The stage is set. And the 8 Vajra, they bring the pilgrims forward, report the mission success scriptures delivered.
And then Rulai calls them up for their official appointments. You can just imagine the anticipation.
Absolutely electric.
So who's first in line? Who gets their reward first?
It's the Tang monk, Xuanzang, which makes sense. He's the master.
Right.
And, you know, his backstory is key here. He was Jin Chanzi, Rulai's own disciple, but got banished for, well, not listening properly, disrespecting the teachings.
Ah, yes, I remember that part. Sent down to the East.
Exactly. But this whole journey, getting the scriptures, his gongu, his meritorious work, it completely redeems him.
So what's the final verdict? His elevation?
He becomes the Chandana Merit Buddha. Chandana Merit Buddha. That title, it really emphasizes the fragrant, purifying merit he built up. All that hard work and dedication.
Wow. From disgraced disciple back to Buddha status. That's quite the arc, a real reconciliation.
It truly is.
Okay, so from the master to his, let's say, most famous disciple.
Hey, yeah. Next up is Sun Wukong, the great sage equal to heaven himself.
Of course.
Rulai looks at him, acknowledging the whole great havoc in heaven, the imprisonment under the mountain, all that history.
But also the journey itself, right?
Absolutely. Rulai specifically praises his success in fighting demons, subduing monsters, you know, all the way through. He achieved, and this is the quote, a complete and perfect end.
A complete and perfect end. Love that. So his reward.
He's elevated to victorious fighting Buddha, Duzan Shengfo.
Victorious fighting Buddha. Fitting, but there's that detail about the golden fillet, isn't there? That thing on his head, was it still there? Did it finally come off?
Yes. He was worried about it. Even after becoming a Buddha, he actually asks the Tang monk, Master, okay, I'm a Buddha now like you, but is this thing still on my head?
Huh. Classic Wukong. Still impatient.
Totally. He's like, are you going to keep reciting that spell? You need to recite the loosening spell right now so I can smash this thing.
So what did the Tang monk say? Did he have a spell for that?
No, and this is beautiful. The Tang monk just calmly explains, well, that fillet was necessary back when you were difficult.
Understatement of the journey.
Right. He says, now that you've achieved Buddhahood, it's naturally gone. Why would it still be there?
Gone. Because he'd changed inwardly.
Exactly. And Wukong touches his head.
Yeah.
And it's gone. Just like that.
Aww.
Imagine the relief.
Wow.
But it's more than just relief, isn't it? It's the ultimate symbol. The external constraint vanishes because the internal transformation is complete. He mastered himself.
That's actually really profound. Self-mastery achieved, not just forced obedience anymore.
Precisely.
Okay, amazing. So next, Zhu Baji. Now, his transformation, or maybe lack thereof in some ways, is kind of funny.
Oh, it definitely brings him humor. His past is Marshal Tianpeng kicked out for getting drunk and bothering maidens.
The Peach Blossom Festival incident. And his appetites on the journey were legendary.
And true to form, what's his immediate reaction to getting his rank?
Let me guess. A complaint.
You got it. He blurts out, hey, they all became Buddhas. How come I'm only an altar cleanser?
An altar cleanser, huh? I can just hear him grumbling. He feels totally ripped off.
Completely. After all that walking and fighting. Or, well, complaining about walking and fighting.
So how does Rulai explain that one? It does seem a bit lower rank.
Well, Rulai's wisdom here is brilliant. He points directly to Baji's nature. Because of his strong mouth and lazy body, wide appetite, he's perfectly suited, Rulai says, to cleanse the altars for all the many Buddhist offerings and feasts across the world.
So, turn his biggest flaw, his gluttony, into a job requirement.
Exactly. Rulai even calls it a rank with much enjoyment, a nice little wink to Baji's love of food. So he's officially the altar cleanser, Jingtan Shizi.
A rank with much enjoyment. That's
It
perfect.
really is. And it shows, that achieving your place isn't about becoming someone else. It's about finding where your specific traits fit in, even the challenging ones.
Integrating the whole self, maybe? Not just erasing the bits we don't like.
That's a great point. A tailored purpose.
Okay, and then there's Shawu Jing, Friar Sand, always so steady, so quiet.
The steadfast one. His past was also pretty rough, though. Curtain rolling general, banished for breaking a cup.
A single cup seems harsh compared to the others.
Well, maybe it was a very important cup. And then his time as a man-eating demon in the flowing Sand River.
Right, not exactly saintly beginnings.
No. But on the journey, utterly sincere, devoted, protected the monk, led the horse, climbed the mountains without complaint. Just solid.
So his consistency paid off.
Big time. For his sincerity, devotion, and all that hard work, Rulai elevates him to golden-bodied arhat, Jinshen Luohan.
Golden-bodied arhat, a state of high spiritual attainment. It shows that quiet, consistent effort counts for a lot.
It absolutely does.
And finally, the horse, often forgotten, but so crucial.
The white dragon horse, originally a dragon prince, son of the dragon king of the West Ocean.
And he got banished for disobeying his dad, right? Unfilial conduct.
That's the one. A serious offense. But Rulai points out his essential role. He carried the monk to the west and then, crucially, carried the scriptures back to the east.
Couldn't have done it without him, literally.
Pretty much. So for that vital service, he becomes the eight-part heavenly dragon horse, Baba Tien Long Ma.
Eight-part heavenly dragon horse. And his transformation scene, the description is
Oh,
incredible.
it's amazing. They lead him to the dragon transformation pond behind the mountain.
And just push him in.
Yep. And instantly, poof, he sheds his horse form, skin, hair, everything. Changes his head, grows horns,
Whoa.
gets golden scales, silver whiskers, starts glowing with this auspicious aura. Clouds appear under his feet.
Seriously, clouds under his feet.
Auspicious clouds. It's this vivid image of complete renewal, purification, ascension.
And then what?
He flies out of the pond, fully transformed back into this magnificent dragon, and coils himself around one of those huge ornate pillars, a Huabiao, right there at the mountain gate.
What a visual, a glorious final form.
Exactly. His metamorphosis is complete. He's reached his true state.
So we've seen all these individual transformations. The monk, Wukong, Baji, Wujing, the horse. What does it all mean together? This true cultivation, Jingguo, reaching their true position, Benwei.
It really signifies the ultimate spiritual payoff, the resolution of all their trials, all their karma from past lives, and this one.
So finding their proper place in the cosmos, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Despite all their flaws, their sins, the journey itself was the process of purification. It allowed them to return to their true spiritual nature. Our source text even has this validating poem,
Oh, right, the
It
puff.
talks about their true essence falling to dust, like when they were banished or suffering. But then through the journey, they complete ranks and escape cycles of transmigration. Basically, they achieved enlightenment, broke the cycle of rebirth, and the scriptures spread, benefiting the world.
And it ends calling them the five saints, right?
Five saints high in the undivided gate, acknowledging their collective success.
So, after all the individual awards, the whole atmosphere at Ling Mountain must have been incredible.
Oh, the descriptions are majestic. Vulture Peak glowing with rosy clouds, Sukhavati, the Western paradise, shimmering with auspicious clouds, pure bliss and harmony.
Like heaven on earth, or, well, heaven in heaven.
Pretty much. All the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Arhats, everyone's there, returned to their places after hearing the Dharma. The text mentions golden dragons, jade tigers, phoenixes, amazing flowers, immortal fruits.
A picture of perfect peace, the ultimate destination achieved.
Definitely.
And to really hammer home their new status, the text finishes with this long list, doesn't it? Praising all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas.
Yes, a long list of veneration. And crucially, it includes our pilgrims by their new titles.
Ah, so it specifically names the Chandana Merit Buddha.
Victorious Fighting Buddha.
Altar Cleanser Bodhisattva. Wait, Bhaji gets called Bodhisattva there.
Some versions list him that way in the final praises, yes. Altar Cleanser Bodhisattva, eight treasured golden-bodied Arhat Bodhisattva for Wujing, and eight-part Heavenly Dragon Great Power Bodhisattva for the horse. It really confirms their arrival, their acceptance into the highest ranks. Their journey is well and truly complete and recognized.